Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. I'm doing another lap with the scientist and financial entrepreneur, Dr. David E. Martin. He's among a select posse of international thought leaders investigating the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, and in particular, the relationships between U.S. public health officials, the pharmaceutical companies, and a number of shadowy organizations behind the development of hugely profitable vaccines with a poor record of safety and viability. We first talked to David a couple of months ago, and this is a fast-moving story, so here we go. David Martin, great to touch base with you again. You've been a great researcher out there in the trenches of the COVID-19 mystery, or mysteries plural. I'm wondering, it seems with this the Omicron story, which is developing after about a week or 10 days into what looks like kind of a flop, have we turned the page in this COVID-19 melodrama?
Well, I think there's a couple ways in which we had. The obvious attempt with Omicron was to turn it into the next fear porn marketing campaign to try to get the reticent or the reluctant to roll up their sleeves. But unfortunately, Germany's Angela Merkel decided to spoil the show by letting everybody know that no matter what the variants are, no matter what anything is, her outgoing announcement just a few days ago was that Germany has adopted this wonderful new policy that says that every 9 months, your vaccination status will be canceled by fiat, and you will have to get whatever's the vax on offer at the time. And I think they timed it badly. You can't get people who are reluctant to agree to a thing when the official other branding campaign is going, oh, by the way, the thing that you were coerced to getting, you know, 9 months ago or a year ago, that thing that you didn't really want to do in the first place, we're going to make you do it now every 9 months just because we're going to tell you that you have to.
And yeah, I think that they're messing that one well. They're messing with a public consensus, which is always very difficult to construct anyway, especially right. In adversity.
Oh, and if you're going to coerce a population into a thing, which is what this thing has been about since 2015, when Peter Daszak said that he was going to coerce the population into accepting a coronavirus vaccine, if you're going to coerce a population, you're not going to get the people who are sitting on the fence to come your way by announcing that, oh, by the way, this is a perpetual addiction now. This is not just a one-time, you know, 15 days back to normal thing. This is a every 9 months. You get to gestate the next whatever toxin, you know, Moderna or Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca or Pfizer can brew up.
Yeah, even this morning, the lead headline in the New York Times is Pfizer BioNTech says booster offers significant protection against Omicron.
Which we know is, you know, I think we can say this on podcast, is a crock of shit.
Yeah.
And the reason why we know that is because to establish efficacy would have taken at least a 28-day, and you heard the number right, because that's actually the minimum incubation period that you could have had from the day the first Omicron variant was identified. It would take 28 days to figure out whether it actually works. And so the fact that we have the announcement from Pfizer inside of a 28-day window means that they have abandoned anything that even remotely resembles science, because there would be no way to tell that other than a computer simulation, and that is not medicine. That's computer science.
So Pfizer is talking out of its great big ass.
Pfizer is doing what it's very, very well known to do, and not surprisingly, BioNTech, which, you know, for those of you paying attention, is a German company, might have something to do with the whole Angela Merkel angle. The likelihood is that looking at that German route is something that I know politically we're not allowed to look at, but socially, and God forbid, you know, historically, it's probably an important thing to look at.
Yeah, are you shocked at the way the Austrians and Germans are behaving now?
No, because if you go back to the Holy Roman Empire, which, you know, I happen to think is worth revisiting, the Austria and Southern Germany consensus around controlling the world has always given rise to autocratic, if not outright fascist, domination. And ironically, the leadership not being as powerful as previous leadership of the region has been is actually trying to flex a muscle that has atrophied since the Second World War. And the fact is that we have, you know, we cannot look at Austria and Germany without looking at Ukraine, because the fact is that, as any historian knows, the Ukrainian, Austrian, German consensus around various trade lines, defense lines, and now pipelines has always been a fulcrum of destabilizing the region, and it has always given rise to fascist leaders. So, you know, I'm not making an accusation. I'm making an observation.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because right now, obviously, the tension is building in Ukraine because the Russians are assembling some troops on their border with Ukraine, which has been a, I guess we could call it a failed state ever since the United States engineered the color revolution in 2014. And the Russians apparently feel a certain amount of anxiety about having a failed state on their border that NATO and the United States are threatening to mess around with.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we obviously hear about the between 175,000, 185,000 Russian troops that are somewhere on a supply line between, you know, Central Russia or parts of Eastern Russia, Western Russia, sorry, and the Ukrainian border. We hear the story of the 185,000 troop issue coming out of intelligence briefings, coming out of now mainstream news. But what we don't talk about is the last now half of a decade where NATO has used Ukraine, both the water bases and the land, as a staging ground to get a further inland NATO presence, which include anti-missile and various intelligence, various listening apparatus, various other defensive postures as part of the NATO wall that has been expanding to the east. And I think that we pay very little attention to the provocation that happens when we approve in Congress the militarization of failed states. I mean, if we go back 30 years ago and we look at the collapse of the Soviet Union and realize that what's going on in Ukraine is the legacy of a power vacuum established by Ukraine falling out of the Soviet bloc, but falling into a rather ill-defined role on the world stage, what you have is a bunch of opportunists. Russia sees it as a way to make sure that the Nord 2 pipeline gets established, and that, by the way, funded by Germany and Austria, 100%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you asked about Germany and Austria. They are the beneficiaries of Russia's energy addiction that is piped through the Nord 2 pipeline. And the U.S. is in an awkward situation because while we are allegedly interested in holding the NATO force together, Germany and Austria are a little bit spoilers in this thing because they actually need the Russian oil.
Of course, and the natural gas, especially.
Well, and gas, but yeah, they need the energy. And the fact of the matter is, I see the whole Russia posturing as a fulcrum to destabilize NATO. I think it has nothing to do with the U.S. and Russia relations. I think mm-hmm. it has everything to do with Putin flexing his muscle and saying, guess what? We've spent the last year and a half watching the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO members. We've watched them incapacitate their troops by making them experimental guinea pigs with this nonsense of injecting all sorts of things that make people sick. So we've softened the battlefield with getting people suboptimally unhealthy. And now what we're going to do is test the strength of NATO. And I think that's what's really happening in the Ukraine.
Yeah, well, let's not forget that when the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. Made an agreement with, I guess, Boris Yeltsin's government that we would not expand NATO.
Correct.
And not bring it closer to their border. And, you know, I don't want to sound like, a Russia apologist necessarily, but let's remember that they have been repeatedly invaded across Ukraine because right. it's a plane without any topography to interfere with the movement of troops. And they don't want that to happen again.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we suffer in this country and around the world, I would have to say, but certainly in the United States, we suffer from this collective amnesia. We enter into agreements, and by the way, politically, we can now say that, you know, we enter into treaties with people, and then we violate treaties, and that's apparently socially acceptable to talk about now. But we can't do the exact same thing when we hold a current administration accountable for the fact that anything that we've done over the last year and a half on NATO expansion has in fact been a violation of the commitments we made when we allegedly, our version of the story is, we won the Cold War. So holding someone accountable, and by the way, I'm not, to your point, I'm not suggesting that I'm defending Russia. I'm simply saying that we can certainly understand why Putin might be incensed by a clear and compelling evidence that the NATO alliance has entirely run roughshod over the agreements that were made.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's just return to Pfizer for a moment. They're now trying to extend the period of time where they don't have to reveal the responses to their early trials of their vaccine. And they've expanded that time window, I think, to 2096, or they're requesting that in any case,
yeah,
of the FDA. And yet it only took the FDA 108 days to review exactly the same documents before allowing the vaccine to be commercialized, sold, and used.
You know, I have to give Del Bigtree and Aaron Seary a ton of credit for their FOIA campaign, because they're trying to keep this thing front and center, and so props to both of them. That it's a wonderful, wonderful emperor has no clothes way to make visible the fact that Pfizer is outright lying. The fact is that the reason why Pfizer doesn't want to release the data is a statute of limitations on civil liability. They don't care at all about the alleged difficulty of redacting information, because let's get something abundantly clear. There's not a shred of proprietary information anywhere in this filing. And the argument that the FDA, argument that BioNTech and Pfizer has made, is that it will take them time. And their argument is that it could take, 500 pages a month or 500 pages a year or whatever the 500 pages, horizon is that they think they're playing with, because they only have 18 professionals, according to them, that they can put on this issue. Somehow or another, it's going to take that long to review everything and make sure they redact proprietary and trade secret information. So let's stipulate a couple things. First, a patent only lasts 20 years. So the great news is there's no chance in hell that it could take them longer than 20 years to produce information, because at the 20-year horizon, there is no more proprietary information to be concerned with. So let's say that they started their patent clock the day they started making the vaccine, which they didn't. As a matter of fact, BioNTech's patents, many of them that revolve around this whole RNA technology, are in fact going to expire between 5 and 10 years from now. So no matter what the argument is, it's entirely disingenuous. The issue is Pfizer has documentation on adverse events and deaths, and it does not want the public to see that. And it doesn't want the public to see that ever. The
yeah.
only proprietary information that possibly exists in their files that they want to pull out are adverse events. And as Aaron Seary and Del Bigtree pointed out in their FOIA filings, it's important to realize that if, in fact, it took 108 days for the FDA to review all of the data, have an informed decision, and make a recommendation for an emergency use authorization, and then, God help us, they've done a shorter review to go all the way to the approval of the diaphanous veil called Comirnaty. The fact of the matter is, suggesting that a review of purging proprietary information would take 55 years or 100 years is absolute insanity. And the fact that they even proposed that is a wonderful piece of evidence saying that they know damn good and well that under the PREP Act, they are required to document their investigations into adverse events and deaths. And as they are the arbiter of who died from a vaccine injury and who got injured from a vaccine or not, the data they're trying to bury is that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the forming of a consensus, or, you know, I guess the new word for this is narrative, and they may not actually be identical terms, but they're close, is a difficult thing. It's like turning an aircraft carrier around in a bathtub. But there seems to be a growing and spreading public awareness that the vaccines are not effective and potentially harmful. Do you get the sense that people are beginning to move in that direction?
Well, there's already rumblings, James, that there are some folks on the inside who are now regretting putting all the eggs in the mRNA basket.
Yeah, like, tell me about that.
Well, so as you know, as recently as 2019, when it came to things like hepatitis C, which was something Anthony Fauci was desperately trying to get a vaccine around for the last 10 years, when it came to NIAID's obsession with trying to get a vaccine for the opioid addiction, which is the other emergency use authorization that NIAID has maintained for longer than there's been a coronavirus EUA. One of the things that's been problematic is that because of investments made by NIH, and specifically the interlocking and antitrust violations that NIH has had with the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and with Moderna, NIH and NIAID desperately wanted mRNA to be the magic bullet because they have a whole bunch of other things in the wings. They want that to be used for a whole bunch of other pathologies. The problem is that mRNA is a gene therapy defined as such by the FDA and disclosed as such in the 20F filings of BioNTech, which with the SEC, and disclosed as such within the 10Ks and 10Qs filed by Moderna. This is not a vaccine. It is a computer code that actually builds an operating system override to your natural immune system, which allows an injection of a computer code into your body so that your body turns on the production of a toxin. And that toxin is the spike protein. Now, I've said this for months and years now, and the problem that we had was Reuters came out right away and said, there's this guy who claims to be Dr. Martin. Ironically, Reuters has my stock file photos when I was on CNBC, and I was Dr. Martin then. Somehow I claimed to be Dr. Martin later. But Reuters came out and said that I was misleading the public, and this is one of those fact check moments. But the fact of the matter is I was reading the SEC filings from those companies. And the problem with gene therapy is that it is not an immunity public health response. It is an individual therapeutic intervention. And that's a big difference. Vaccines used to be things that we gave so that you don't get sick and pass it to others. That's the whole point of public health.
Mm-hmm.
And gene therapy is like prophylactic chemotherapy. You know, if I told everybody to go out and take prophylactic chemotherapy for the pancreatic cancer they might have, people would go, yeah, no, I kind of don't want it. Now, James, you and I are at a deficit because we already don't have hair, so we can't at least make the argument that we'll lose our sexy locks. But the fact of the matter is prophylactic chemotherapy is a bad idea, just like prophylactic gene therapy is a bad idea. And the public is starting to wake up to the fact that, oh, hold on a minute, this thing never was about stopping infection. This thing was never about stopping transmission. It was about allegedly reducing the severity of symptoms. And the problem with the story is people who have gotten the shot still get sick. And many of the people who get the shot now drop over with myocarditis and other cardiovascular problems. And it kind of sucks when you've been lying to the public this long, What's now happening is they're doubling down on the fact that, well, at least our boosters are safe. Well, they're not. They never were, just like the first injections weren't.
Our newest sponsor is Sage Restoration, a fine company specializing in high-quality traditional paints and materials for building preservation. They'd like to reach all you listeners out there living in the long emergency who are ready to start building a world made by hand. And by the way, they sent me some complimentary refined linseed oil, one of their products. I happen to be a painter myself, an art painter, and I cooked up a batch of my usual painting medium with their product, and boy, was I pleased with that. And now a few words from our sponsor. Peeling paint and rotten wood are modern problems brought on by modern plastic materials. But our building history tells us that it doesn't have to be that way. Craftsmen from the past use natural oil paints and resins to protect wood from the inside out rather than the plastic coatings of today that trap moisture and leave us with a rotten, peeling mess. As specialists in traditional wood preservation, Sage Restoration offers a whole new generation of linseed oil finishes for preserving wood and metal that lasts for decades, that do not peel, and that are easy to maintain. At Sage Restoration, it is our mission to restore our connection to traditional materials that have been proven over time and work to return the built environment to one that is worth caring about. For more information, visit their website at sagerestoration.com. That's one word, sagerestoration.com. Sage Restoration also sponsors the Eyesore of the Month feature on the Kunstler.com website. We thought that would be a refreshing counterpoint to the typical eyesore buildings we present each month. And now back to the podcast. I'm wondering how bad this fiasco is with the mRNA program generally. Now, as I understand it, when Robert Malone became interested in developing mRNA technology, that he was initially looking to treat cancers.
Yep.
By finding a pathway into cells to reprogram the cells.
That's exactly right. That's where all of this stuff started.
So this thing has gone terribly wrong, and it seems to have infected the entire medical and public health establishment so badly that it is in the process of discrediting medicine generally. That's a pretty dangerous place to go.
Well, and that's what happens. I mean, this thing was a lottery odds play. If we go back and remember that between the 29th of January and the 31st of January, Alex Azar, who many people seem to forget, was under the Bush administration, the guy who took us from the anthrax attack right up to the PrEP Act, which was the way in which we got immunity from liability for vaccine and drug companies back in the Bush administration. So the 2005, national protection against biological warfare, we needed to make sure that drug companies were immune from prosecution. The same Alex Azar who was doing that wound up being the guy who went to Eli Lilly and orchestrated a massive criminal conspiracy, which involved manipulating the price of insulin in Mexico. And, for some mysterious reason, people don't realize that when he was appointed back to the Department of Health and Human Services, he was actually still part of a very significant investigation into Eli Lilly's insulin scandals. So this guy who allegedly was going to champion for, the public interest and the reduction of the cost of healthcare and everything else, if we go back and look at his tenure under the Bush administration, we realize he was put there to build an immunity shield that extended past the 1986 Act, which was the National Childhood Immunization Shield that was put in place under the Reagan administration. And if we look at his track record, what we see is that he was set up to build an immunity shield for companies. He then went to a drug company and started committing what turned out to be civil violations of price fixing. And then went back in just in time to somehow mysteriously go from saying on the 29th of January 2020 that there was no need to be worried. There was no epidemic. There was no pandemic. And the country was going to be fine against coronavirus, to 2 days later declaring a national emergency. Now, James, if you go back and look at the history, there was no new information between January 29 and January 31st. So January 29, 2020, he said there was no problem, told the president there was no problem. The president said he was told there was no problem. And 2 days later, we have the EUA. And the EUA very clearly came from communication with industry. And we know that that communication was going on because Moderna has admitted to it. Mm-hmm. That somewhere in that latter phase of January, people said, hey, this is our moment to put all of the eggs in the mRNA basket.
So they struck while the iron was hot.
They had to strike while the iron was hot, because if you recall, and I know you would recall this back many years ago when we had Dolly the sheep, you know, all the cloning conversations.
Yeah.
And the public lost their mind about scientists playing God or Frankenstein or fill in the blank of whatever your horrific metaphor was. The fact is that gene therapy had the same reputation. And the only way you were going to get that through, and then its evil stepchild, because remember, mRNA is the gateway drug to the real win. The real win is gene editing technology in the form of CRISPR.
Mm-hmm.
Because gene editing technology is something that you could not get things like the Catholic Church to buy off on until you got the Pope to tell everybody to take a shot, only to then find out that you're now going to have to use CRISPR to edit the crap out of the shot. Now we've got the Vatican backed into a corner. We've got the religious right backed into a corner, because everybody who said they were going to oppose gene editing is now going to be crying for gene editing to get rid of the nonsense that we created with the mRNA shot.
You know, that's something that I haven't heard. Are you saying that there is a lot of chatter? Because I haven't seen any or heard any chatter that they're planning or thinking of using CRISPR to correct the problems they've caused with all of these vaccinations.
Go back and look at who wrote the check for Event 201 in October of 2019.
Oh, I wouldn't know where to look.
Yeah, well, the cool thing is it was on a press release then, and if you didn't look then, it's hard to find now. Good news is I looked then and found it then. But if you go back and look, Event 201, which was the tabletop exercise for the SARS coronavirus outbreak, was funded by Dustin Moskowitz and the Open Philanthropy Foundation. He is the co-founder of Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg, the guy you've never heard of. He's a multi-billionaire, and he happens to be one of the largest investors in the gene editing technology CRISPR, which he's done in joint venture with a Chinese set of researchers in Massachusetts. The fact of the matter is, CRISPR never had a chance to see the light of day. Never. Because it is the Frankenstein bad dream of deciding whether or not we're going to select gender, whether we're going to select particular attributes in a child, whether we're going to amplify certain traits or suppress certain traits. Everything that has been what the religious right and the Catholic Church and others have stood against, which is playing God in a lab, is what CRISPR is. And CRISPR wrote the check for the Event 201.
Was that the dress rehearsal for COVID-19?
Of course it was.
Yeah.
And it's the thing that had every single detail, including the press photos, including the people are in short supply of masks. And, you know, their simulated news was exactly the script CNN used.
Hey, remind listeners what CRISPR is an acronym for.
So what it is a gene editing technology which allows people to actually do what are called palindromic replications. And so a palindrome, part of the reason why it's such a challenge is because people forget what palindromes are. It's things that actually look the same end to end.
Or that are spelled the same backwards and forwards.
Yeah, exactly. And what happens is that in CRISPR technology, what you're doing is you're clipping sequences of palindromic repeats. And that's the large, you know, simple way to summarize what the technology is.
Of proteins.
It's exactly right. Of nucleic acid sequence, not just proteins, just the sequences that build those nucleic acids that turn into the things that make proteins, that manufacture and express certain genes and so forth. So what CRISPR does is it allows us to go in and clip in or clip out of the genome things that we want to express or we want to suppress. It turns out that it's, by the way, CRISPR, which had been invented a decade earlier, you know, in this nonsensical world we live in, James, the Nobel Prize in 2020 went to the alleged two women who invented CRISPR. Hmm. And none of us paid attention to the fact that that's what the Nobel Prize went to in December of 2020. And you sit back and say, well, hold on a minute. With all of the cool stuff going on with mRNA, with all the cool stuff going on with genes, and with all the cool stuff going on with viruses, why did the award go to CRISPR? Well, it turns out that this entire campaign has been orchestrated in part to get the camel's nose of CRISPR under the tent under an emergency use authorization. And surprise, surprise, it worked. Because while everybody was talking about mRNA vaccines, when everybody was talking about, you know, what we were going to do with emergency use authorizations for all sorts of other nonsense, the first EUAs on CRISPR were authorized and not a soul talked about it.
Well, yeah.
Not a soul. I did, but I was kind of a prophet eating locusts in the wilderness.
Oh. Well, the federal law enforcement apparatus, namely the Department of Justice, which might be the body that would look into some of this, is pretty much a hostage to the whole process now. But are there any efforts at the state or county levels by attorneys general or district attorneys to file charges against the vaccine executives, the politicians, the public health officials, hospital administrators, doctors, for crimes ranging from negligence to outright homicide?
Yeah, so since our last conversation, James, I have been, as you know, a kind of a lone drummer out on the horizon, just banging my drum on this thing. And the great news is a couple people have heard the drum. I have been finally, after several very interesting interactions, invited to places like Texas, Utah, Montana, Missouri, other places around the country where people within the AG's office or the AG themselves has said, hey, we think you might be onto something. And specifically the three primary families of crimes that I've been talking about, obviously most significantly the antitrust laws, which involve the corporations, NIH, NIAID, CDC, the FDA, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who all have very clearly on their face committed antitrust violations of the Sherman and the Clayton Act. In addition, I've talked about the Biological Weapons and Domestic Terrorism Acts, which are all felonies, and those have to do with the admission by people at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, including alumni thereof, most notably Kizzy Corbett, the doctor who is given credit for coming up with the Moderna injection, who is an alum of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, conveniently.
Was she a research assistant for Barrack?
I'm sorry?
Was she a research assistant for Ralph Barrack?
Yeah, well, she worked in the UNC lab, and then she went to the Vaccine Research Center at NIAID. And so she is literally the gateway drug from UNC inside the NIH tent. And in her interview with Francis Collins several months ago, she admitted to the same thing Ralph Barrack admitted to, which is to take a viral model uploaded from a Chinese database and a Chinese server of a virus known to be exceptionally harmful to humans. Both of them admitted to replicating that virus based on a computer code they got from the Chinese here in the United States. There are so many laws that violates, we can't even count them all. But the Biological Weapons and the Domestic Terrorism Acts are the second class of laws. And most recently, because of what's going on with the data that is being suppressed out of the manufacturers, I've actually also suggested there are, in fact, either manslaughter or homicide or potentially premeditated murder charges that could be laid against the same people. Now, the great news is I have had very good constructive conversations with many AG offices. The bad news, James, is that in each case, I have been told that while the facts are in fact clear that crimes were committed, and now unfortunately I'm quoting from two, and I will not name which two, but two of the AG offices who said this is a political, not a legal matter.
Well, yeah, but what do you suppose they mean by that? Are they being pressured? I mean, we know it's a political matter. It's a political melodrama. And, you know, the whole thing has largely been about attempting to just coerce the American people and soften them up for future coercion.
Well, no question. And that's, I think, the point. You know, inside of 21 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 50.23 and 24, it makes it abundantly clear that you are not allowed, even in an emergency, to coerce a population into participating in an experimental therapy. And that law is clear. It has been clear for years. It is the way in which the Nuremberg Code, the 10 sections of the Nuremberg Code, were codified in U.S. law. So 21 Code of Federal Regulations is the law. And despite the fact that a lot of mainstream media has said that, you know, the U.S. never ratified the Nuremberg Code, which technically is correct, 21 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 50.23 and 24, are the codification of the principles within the Nuremberg Code. And they very clearly say no person under any circumstance can be coerced into taking experimental therapy. The same thing is, in fact, the case if you look at the Code of Military Justice, something that neither the previous administration nor this administration seems willing to do, because coercion is never authorized. And that means that you can't be forced to do something that you would not otherwise voluntarily and willfully do, fully informed of all the facts. You cannot be forced to do it with threat of loss of job, loss of access, loss of anything else. So when you're in the state of New York and they say you can't go into a restaurant unless you've had the shot, that is coercion. And nobody seems to bother reading the federal statute that says that's illegal. But interestingly enough, the Section 802 of the Patriot Act, which was, by the way, in force at the start of all this nonsense, Section 802 says that if you coerce a government into an action, that's even a bigger problem. That's actually domestic terrorism. And it turns out that Alex Azar and Anthony Fauci coerced the Trump administration into signing over their executive authority to two unelected people, so that Alex Azar and Anthony Fauci ran the country.
You know, I've been looking back on all those daily briefings that took place in 2020 with Donald Trump and Fauci and Deborah Birx and the rest of them, you know, meeting every day and making statements. And, you know, I'm more and more impressed by my remembering my impression. And this is, by the way, acknowledging, you know, what a disconcerting character Donald Trump was for a lot of people. But it was hard to miss how uncomfortable he looked during those sessions, as though he knew he was being played.
Yeah, exactly. And I have pointed out that at the end of the day, I still am old fashioned. I still think the executive in chief is, in fact, the executive in chief. And if your appointed officials are corrupt, ultimately it becomes your responsibility. But I think that in the case of President Trump, it was very difficult for him to understand the nuance of the issues. And so I do think that he was being played, and I think he didn't know it.
Well, you know, the forces arrayed against him in the form of the entire public health apparatus of America, you know, it's kind of hard to just go up against that and say, no, you guys are playing the public.
Right.
I mean, how could he have done that gotten anywhere doing that?
Well, you know, he could have done it. I mean, there were people, you know, within his influence circle who were desperately trying to feed him the stuff that I was trying to share with the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that they were going through filters and they were going up against walls. And so, you know, my grandfather was famous in saying, never attribute to malevolence that which is ignorance. And I think in this particular case, I have to do that, even though I'm disheartened by the fact that, you know, I was not effective in communicating as much as I would have liked to have been during that time. But I can also say that even I have to look at the fact that the forces, to your point, that are arrayed against having an informed discussion are so complete that it is not surprising that one or two voices can't override the din and the cacophony of this constant drumbeat of fear porn and deaths and destruction and all of those kinds of things. And I get it.
Let's not forget that the American press was completely AWOL on this whole thing.
Well, and still is, by the way.
Yeah, still is.
We have had now on three occasions, I believe, the New York Times alleged to have a reporter who allegedly is at least interested in hearing what they're calling my side of the story. And the editorial staff winds up never showing up for the story. I had for several months interactions with the Financial Times because they were going to write a smear piece like everybody else did on Mickey Willis's film Plandemic 2, which featured me and a lot of the material that I've been making public. Mm-hmm. And ironically, Isabella Kaminska, the editor of one of the Financial Times pieces, actually had the decency of reaching out and calling me and saying, hey, we're writing a piece and we wondered if you'd comment on it. And after about a 2.5 or 3 hour conversation over, I think, two calls, she said, well, hold on a minute. It sounds like there's a bunch of credible stuff we should be looking into. And then over the ensuing year, she and I worked together on sending information back and forth. And she actually wound up writing a piece, which supposedly was sent to the editorial staff at the Financial Times, which was, in fact, my material.
Mm-hmm.
And that story never got published. Now, what they did do, and she was one of the authors in the byline on two articles, they were the first publication to actually link biological weapons and coronavirus, at least in the same story, which mm-hmm. I have to give them credit for because none of the other mainstream press has been willing to even do that. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the lead piece that they did was on biologically manipulating, of all things, beer, where somebody was figuring out how to use mRNA to conjure up their own boutique yeasts for their home brew and suggesting that if you could do it for beer, you could probably destroy the world. to say it was a fluff piece is an offense to fluff. It was a piece of shit. But to their credit, Financial Times was the only one that even engaged the story. None of the other media outlets. And by the way, that includes mainstream TV. As much as people celebrate Fox and they celebrate kind of some of the alt media, none of them are willing to do this because this actually is a road too far.
Mm-hmm. I want to sort of try to clarify one point here, which is that, you know, much of what we're talking about involves enormous bureaucracies and institutions and corporations.
Correct.
I'm wondering, who are the most prosecutable human figures in the whole scheme who are attached to those gigantic, faceless bureaucracies? And is it possible that they are actually going to be culpable for these actions and for the all the mischief and death that they've caused?
Well, I think in order of easy to take down, the guy whose fingerprints are on the bag of money stolen from the bank is Peter Daszak.
Mm-hmm.
There is no question that if you wanted a low collateral damage, high visibility takedown, Peter Daszak is without question the easiest target because he's made the most public admissions and the most brazen statements about how conveniently engineerable coronavirus is. And after the release of his DARPA proposal that, you know, people thought was ridiculous a few months ago, where he actually suggested weaponizing coronavirus, spraying it in a bat cave and seeing what happened to the bats, which, you know, he actually wrote that. So when you realize that this guy is Frankenstein in modern form. It's not hard to develop a case around Peter Daszak's admission that he was going to coerce the population using media hype. That's a quote from 2015, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in 2016. You know, the good news about him is he was not close enough to the Trump circle to make it look like a MAGA issue, right? So this is this is not going to inflame the January 6th committee into another, you know, frenzy. And the good news is that the discovery in that trial, which would be beautiful, would actually give you the pathway to access the inside communications between Fauci and Moderna, between Fauci and a bunch of other people, because we know that the next one which you really would go after is Fauci and Barrick. And those two, because they're the ones that actually architected the way in which we could turn the spike protein against humanity, those two are really horrible, horrible actors on the stage. But to get to them, you'd want to kind of build the prosecution. And Daszak would be the easiest target, followed by Fauci and Barrick. And once you got Fauci and Barrick, that would get you the ICTV, the International Committee on the Taxonomy of Viruses. That's the World Health Organization's uber secret, you know, kind of underground lair. That's the bat cave of bat caves.
I've never heard of them.
You go and you define what are going to be the pathogens of concern that the world's going to be in fear of. And once you get that record, you now find the people who are actually running the show.
Hey, everybody. We're proud of our association with David McElvaney's ICA Wealth Management as a sponsor of this podcast. And I recommend you listen to the McElvaney Weekly Commentary, David's fine podcast, out every Tuesday and available at iTunes Podcasts. Gold has been on a roller coaster, but we got a clue about where it's moving later this year. Think money printing from sea to shining sea. Can you spot an inflationary trend? When dollars lose purchasing power, it's time to think about wealth preservation. It's time to think about gold. There is no better asset for building a stable foundation for your portfolio, and Vaulted is the easiest way to invest in gold. Vaulted is an online mobile web app for investing in allocated and deliverable physical gold. Buy and secure gold with ease and convenience, giving you full control over securing your financial future. Vaulted delivers the best prices every time, along with personal advising from the experts at McElvaney ICA. Join thousands of investors who have discovered these benefits for wealth preservation in an increasingly worrisome time. Visit Kunstler.com/vaulted to learn more about the Vaulted program at McElvaney ICA and earn this podcast a referral point when you sign up. That's Kunstler.com/vaulted, V-A-U-L-T-E-D. And now back to the show. Let's just shift over to a few other issues because we're already at the three-quarter mark of this chat.
And, it's so much fun, James. I feel like time stands still when I'm talking to you.
Well, thank you very much. And I feel the same way. I feel like I'm standing under a fire hose of very important information. Here's something that struck me, and I'm wondering what your opinion is. How many of the COVID deaths, especially in the early phases of the pandemic and winter, spring, summer of 2020, how many of those deaths were actually due to remdesivir? And, you know, since the toxic effect on organs and lungs and kidneys is very similar to the actions of COVID-19 in remdesivir. So it would have been, in a practical sense, for doctors who had very little experience with this whole dynamic, indistinguishable to them.
Well, and the good news is because we don't have necropsies and autopsies on a lot of these people, the answer is, my guess is as bad as everybody else's guess. And the people who know the answer have buried the evidence.
Yeah, so we'll never know.
I don't think we will ever know the precise accounting for this. What I have pointed to many times, and I know this is old-fashioned, and I know that I wear a bow tie, so I'm cliche about things like this. But the fact of the matter is that we have a tiny technical problem, and that is we are constantly reminded of what we're called excess deaths.
Yeah.
And depending on whose statistics you use, you are told that you're supposed to believe that there were these mass kill-offs that happened last year. The problem is twofold. Number one is influenza stopped being a killer conveniently halfway through the flu season. And we are being told by the people who explain that, that influenza competes with coronavirus and loses. And so what used to be an influenza death becomes a COVID death by virtue of a mysterious thing that has never been established in any piece of scientific literature ever called viral competition. This is like a pay-per-view cage match where, you know, flu comes in, COVID comes in. There's this giant, you know, kind of round one, round two, and then COVID knocks out influenza. And if you believe that, you've been watching too much WWE.
Well, I'd make the leap that it's possible that what we were seeing were a lot of influenza infections in very old people and people with comorbidities who were then basically knocked off the game board with remdesivir, which destroyed their kidneys and lungs.
Remdesivir and a bunch of other things. I mean, remember that we were filling people with all sorts of alleged emergency, you know, oxygen supplementation or intubation or ventilation. We were doing a bunch of things wrong and then wondering why people were getting pleural effusions, meaning their lungs were filling with liquid and then they were drowning in their own liquid, and we're wondering why that killed them.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is physicians and their malpractice killed an enormous number of people in early 2020, and as we started adding remdesivir to the mix, we knew in every piece of clinical data that remdesivir had a huge tox problem, but we put those into immune compromised people. And lo and behold, when you put a already dangerous substance into people who are already really sick, it turns out that you accelerate the end of those people. The amount of malpractice and the amount of negligent, at least homicide, that was done in the name of medicine in 2020 and 2021 is too numerous to count.
Well, this whole affair has made doctors look stupendously dumb and cowardly.
Well, and I think we have to wake up to a very, very simple fact that while we watched major healthcare systems get consolidated in the name of, you know, private equity or public equity fantasies, where somehow or another the best thing in the world was to build hospitals that were not individual community hospitals, but were these mega corporations that have, you know, every doctor's office, every clinic, everything is all under this giant umbrella, whether it's Kaiser, United Health, or, you know, Anthem, or any, you know, the insurance agencies that got together with hospitals, and all of a sudden we had this blurring of lines. We created this unbelievably complex Medusa that we call healthcare. And what it is a simple structure at the bottom. And the simple structure at the bottom is a bunch of shareholders that figured out getting on the Medicare, Medicaid gravy train was the best way to build an annuity in the form of an equity product. So the great news is the reason why you buy up healthcare systems is because you're going to defraud the government by mass billing of the Medicare system. And that's the reason why all of the hospital consolidations took place. Now, obviously, if you're Kaiser, you're upset that I said that. If you're United Healthcare, you're upset that I said that. But I don't care, because that's the truth. The truth is that we stopped caring about health and we started caring about mass production of drug dealing.
And speaking of drug dealing, the current perhaps final mad rush to vaccinate the remaining unvaxxed of the population begins to look like an attempt to remove the control group, a kind of desperate attempt to remove the control group.
No question. And one of the tragedies in this is that if you are not in the intervention group, if you're not in the injection group, you are being told that you are some sort of, you know, social pariah, or you're sure. You're an outcast. You're a leper in the giant world of the enlightened injected. But the fact of the matter is, one of the things that's fascinating is that we're seeing people who are being hospitalized for all sorts of things who mysteriously go into the hospital for, you know, a little bit of a problem, maybe a little infection here or there, and they conveniently get on a COVID protocol. So they get filled with remdesivir. They get filled with all kinds of other things. And the irony of this, and James, I have to point out, the self-evident nature of the lies I'm telling right now needs to be clarified against the following backdrop, because everybody who wants to say, well, Dave, you're spinning the facts, they have to look at a very simple thing. The emergency use authorization for a vaccine, and I am not, by the way, stipulating this is, but I'm saying even if it was, the only characterization that can be done to stipulate that a vaccine is mandatory is when there are no therapeutic alternatives.
Yeah.
Now, the irony is, technically speaking, the emergency use authorization that includes the use of this injection is no longer even legal, because you can't inject an experimental injection if there is a clinical alternative. And according to the FDA, there are two. There is a treatment, happens to kill you, but there is a treatment called remdesivir. And most recently, and by the way, UNC Chapel Hill and Vanderbilt are dancing again, because when the Merck Ridgeback Pharmaceuticals drug that just got authorized, we now have a second treatment, which is in fact a treatment, not an injection. So yeah. Anyone who is currently compelling or even insinuating compelling an injection is violating the EUA by statute.
Well, I guess anything goes and nothing matters. But
yeah, it's worth pointing out, though. I mean, at least I'm on record saying it.
Yeah, well, remdesivir has demonstrated that it's ineffective and dangerous.
Yep.
And we've known this now for months and months and months. How is it possible that doctors are still using it promiscuously?
Because the consolidated healthcare systems are the ones writing the remdesivir protocol. They're paid to do that by CMS, and they will do what they get paid for. And until congressional resources actually step up and compel, by the way, you know, James, you and I are old enough to remember those wonderful days of when Ma Bell got broken up.
Uh-huh.
When the antitrust laws were
enforced,
used appropriately to say that, hey, you know, when there is only one telephone carrier in the country, for the majority of consumers, that's not a competitive marketplace. The same thing needs to be done with healthcare. We need to break up the massive, massive, massive healthcare consortiums, mm-hmm. because they are the reason why we cannot even have physicians doing what remotely resembles their own ethical thing. Because yeah. CMS and the corporate hospital chains have decided that they are going to get into a financing racket, and nothing is more lucrative than a COVID patient on a remdesivir protocol in an ICU getting hundreds of thousands of dollars a day. That is a money printing machine. And as long as we allow that to go on, humans are going to be killed for corporate profit.
Well, you know, there was a story out about a week ago that a lawyer in Illinois got a court order forcing the doctors in a hospital where his client patient was being treated with intubation and remdesivir, and they got a court order to treat this gravely ill patient with the ivermectin protocol, and then he recovered in like 2 days.
Right.
Why have there not been more cases like this, more lawyers seeking court orders for treatment? And why are hospital administrators not being held accountable for preventing the treatment?
Well, the day of reckoning is going to come, but I mean, we got to go back and look at my previous point. The point is that Medicare, Medicaid, the Biden administration and hospital administration are in bed with each other. And as long as the financial incentive says get people who are sick to be sicker, more dependent on high expensive treatments and protocols, and then get them to a state of persistent vegetative expense, the fact is that it's good business. Until we make it bad business, until we realize that these are crimes and hospital administrators are guilty of murder, until we do that, we're going to see more people unnecessarily suffering and dying in the name of a public health, you know, alleged pandemic, which is nothing more than a class action opportunity to go after, you know, the civil side of this, as well as the criminal actions I've enumerated before. And the reason why more attorneys aren't doing this is because attorneys have not informed themselves about the fact that this is a criminal conspiracy. And they're stipulating facts like there's a coronavirus, stipulating facts like there's a disease called COVID-19, stipulating the facts that there's a thing called a vaccine. And unfortunately, when lawyers stipulate facts that are not facts, they lose for the public interest, they lose for the social interest, and they ultimately embarrass their profession.
So the attorneys and the doctors have embarrassed their professions.
No question.
And I, you know, to me, I think this is part of another angle on this whole fiasco. And I guess this will be the final thing I'd like you to talk about. I suppose you've read by or heard by now Matthias Desmet's ideas about mass formation psychosis.
Yeah.
You know, it's been pretty hot on the web for the last 2-3 weeks. And I wrote about it quite a bit in my blogs over the last 2 weeks. But the question is, how does a society get out of that? How does a society get out of this state of mind, this collective state of mind that is gripping it and creating tremendous havoc?
Well, the question is a great one, and I think my answer is probably one of the things that I'm most concerned about. If we look at our historical trajectory, we have a bad track record of not getting out of it. What we do is we go into transference and substitution.
Yeah, explain that a bit.
Yeah, so one of the things, and I've been watching the same kind of firestorm of ideas. By the way, I actually love the argument, but my downside is if we go back to Gregory Bateson's work, and by the way, if you haven't read Gregory Bateson's work, I highly recommend it, specifically his work on what he refers to as the double bind.
Is he also the hierarchy of needs guy?
What? No, that's Maslow.
Oh, excuse me.
Gregory Bateson was a beautiful mind, gentleman who worked with post-traumatic Korean, some Second World War, Korean and Vietnam veterans, and tried to unpack what was going on with kind of the psychological issues that were associated with a lot of the post-traumatic vets coming back from the war. And he talked about this thing where you observe a set of facts, you see them for what they are objectively, and then you have a narrative that's so compelling that it overrides your ability to perceive your own senses, so much so that you actually have a cognitive shift, and it leads to what he referred to as a post-traumatic schizophrenia, where quite literally the self-evident nature of what you see in front of you, you assume is wrong, and you wait for someone else to fill in the narrative. And his work is profound in many respects, but the reason why I see it as instructive and slightly disconcerted is, let's say we wave a magic wand and we have a Peter Daszak, you know, Anthony Fauci, Ralph Baer perp walk, which I think would be wonderful. The problem is that by tearing apart this narrative, the risk would be that the public would then look for a new consensus narrative.
Yeah.
Rather than waking up to the real issue, which is, hold on a minute, you need to step back and start doing the hard work of being a critical thinker, being capable of your own critical thought, being capable of trusting your own intuition and your own perception, rather than doing that, history shows us that people substitute one idolatry for another. We don't have a good track record of moving out of one idolatry and into a plurality of perspectives. That's not something that humans have been very good at. And so my big concern is, God forbid we actually have an accountability moment, the likelihood is we would just supplant one, you know, kind of hegemonic rule for another, rather than having an examined view of this thing and going, hold on a minute, we've got some fundamental human stuff we got to get right. And I think about this in light of back in 2003, my first time ever being exposed to you on stage or any of your work. And I have to admit that I was an absolute blind fool when I walked in and left a believer. But when you got up and talked about what had happened with the way the desertification of the urban space was prolific across society, where we accepted strip malls as an architecture. Mm-hmm. And we accepted the, I think it was the Boston Public Library that you lampooned in that speech.
City Hall.
City Hall, that's what it was. But, you know, when we accept things that are visually offensive and then we celebrate them as something that they're not, what we're doing is programming our society into exactly what we're seeing now. And I would say that if you reprise that speech in 2003 right now, you could very easily be one of the heralded, you know, scions that got to see the future. And you, the oracle in 2003, were saying, hey, hold on a minute. If we build a city hall like the one in Boston and call it an aesthetic wonder, we are going to have COVID-19. and the reason for it is very simple. The cognitive dissonance, when it becomes not only establishment, but it goes beyond that, because you actually have black tie events to celebrate architects who were visual blight manufacturers.
I think we're discovering that the public consensus is a very fragile thing and not something you want to mess around with.
That's exactly right. And so I think where we are is a situation where I really hope that we can find a careful way to emerge, which does not replace one horrific hegemonic, you know, psychosis for another.
Yeah, that's an excellent way to put it. Well, David, on that note, I think we're going to conclude at the just past the hour mark. And I look forward to continuing to touch base with you as this melodrama rolls out. And we will ride again.
Very good. Thanks, James.